Next thing, there's a thing called the city beautiful. This is a very important concept in sociology. The city beautiful. It's a term in urban planning. It was started back in the early 1900s when Chicago had its centennial. And they had the Columbia World Exposition. Books have been written about this. You can get photographs of the great, they call it the Great White City. As a matter of fact, there's a best-selling novel now about the Great White City and its construction and all the drama that went with it. Intriguing. There was this exposition of the beautiful city. I mean, the exposition wasn't just displays. It was a construction of the beautiful city. The problem was what everybody thought was made out of stone was really made out of plaster. And one night, the Great White City burned down. Only one building that wasn't made out of plaster remains, and that's the Industrial Museum that is still there where the Great White City was once located. But this magnificent city, it's absolutely beautiful if you ever see pictures of it. In the old days, when I was teaching regularly, I always had pictures and I would show slides of the Great White City. It was mind-boggling beautiful. And the buildings were all built with neoclassical architecture. Columns, Corinthian columns, built like the Acropolis. It was magnificent, and it was all in white plaster, so it literally glistened, especially at night when they turned lights on. It just, I mean, it was the magnificence of this whole thing was mind-boggling. This great white city, this great exposition, the Columbia World Exposition, changed American city life. From that point on, the concept was given of the city beautiful. If they did it in that exposition, why can't we do it in Philadelphia? Why can't we do it in San Francisco? Why can't we do it? Why can't we make our cities beautiful? You say, well, you can't tell people how to build. No, but we can do something else. What we can do is tear out a big section of the inner city and turn them into public buildings. And because they're public buildings, the government can decide how they were constructed, how they would be constructed. And so they were constructed with this classical architecture. One of the great tragedies in my lifetime was one of the most beautiful buildings in New York was torn down. Jackie Kennedy worked overtime trying to save the old Pennsylvania Railroad Station at 34th and 8th Avenue. She worked overtime. It didn't work. They tore it down, and they tore down the old Madison Square Garden and built the monstrosity that we presently have on our hands. This is crazy, but it was colonnaded all the way around. And if you want to get a taste of what it looked like, next time you go to that station, get out, walk over to 7th Avenue, look across the avenue, and you'll see the old post office building. And it's classic architecture. Columns all around the thing. I mean, it's just absolutely magnificent buildings. The last truly classical building, and considered by many to be the most beautiful city building ever built under the auspices of a city, under city architecture, is in Philadelphia. It's the 30th Street Station. What a magnificent building. The architecture of that thing is fantastic, for it brings together two things that were happening during the 30s. Namely, the city beautiful concept was intact, and it was also the era of Art Deco. And if you look at the 30th Street Station, it is a magnificent blend of Art Deco architecture and classical architecture. I don't know who designed the thing, but I got to tell you, every architect loves that building. People said it couldn't be done. You couldn't create classical and put it together with Art Deco, but in Philadelphia, 30th Street Station, they did it. The next time you go down there, please go in and look at the building now with the eyes of a sociologist and see the blending of these two cultures. And when you go inside, Go to the McDonald's that's inside the station. Have any of you been to that McDonald's? It's decorated Art Deco out of the 30s. It's absolutely magnificent. What a building. Now, these are the things that you begin to do when you go into a city. You look at the art. Everybody laughs at Philadelphia because they say they've got such strange sculpture. For instance, right diagonally on the southwest corner, on the west side of City Hall, look slightly to your left across Market Street, and there's a great symbol of Philadelphia, this gigantic clothespin. And everybody says, what? This is ludicrous. It's not ludicrous. In city architecture, this is what you need to know. This is what sociologists makes the whole discipline so fascinating. You have to learn architecture. Why did they do this? Because an artist will tell you what urban statuary should do is not simply show you a beautiful piece of art. It should change the feeling of the space that surrounds it. Let me say this quite simply. From now on, when you go into a city and you see a piece of art, a piece of statuary, don't just look at the piece of statuary. Ask the simple question, what did it do to the space around it? How did it affect the space around it? All of a sudden, this barren corner becomes absolutely fascinating, not because of the clothespin, but what the clothespin does to the whole area. There's some Picasso art in downtown Chicago, a huge metal thing, and you say, it's ugly. It is ugly. What does it do to everything around it? It highlights the beauty of everything around it. That's what a great artist does. The great artist doesn't just say, I'm going to build this thing and you can put it anywhere you want. Goes and studies the space where the piece is going to sit and say, I want to create a piece that's going to affect this space in a way that will accentuate the beauty of what's around it. You know, good architecture, for instance, always asks the question, if we're going to put up a new building, what's it going to do to the buildings that sit around it? How's it going to impact those buildings? The wrong building in the wrong place, the right building in the wrong place can look ugly. That same building in another place will look absolutely beautiful. The Guggenheim Museum in New York is a good example. I mean, if you look at that building and ask, what if it was situated in King of Prussia? They would think it's simply part of the shopping center. And I guess you have a lot of shops as you walk up around those, if you've ever been in the Guggenheim. No, but where it is located, right across the street from the park, the whole way in which the whole setting is accentuated. Architecture, sculpture, obviously describes things, do you see? Incidentally, Sorokin, one of the great sociologists, said, architecture needs to be studied because architects are the people who get the feel for the future before anybody else does. Do you see? For instance, during the Victorian era, when everybody was sexually uptight, right? Architecture was extremely, here's the word he used, sensate. It appealed to the senses. Namely, these people who were stunned if you showed 3 inches of flesh would put a statue right in front of City Hall with a naked woman. Go down to Logan Square. I mean, I said it's magnificent statuary. You'll see 4 huge naked women.
Today.
Today, yeah. But I mean, it's only in metal. Don't get all excited. But did you ever wonder about that? I mean, I loved it. I loved it when Ashcroft, who is an Assemblies of God fundamentalist, became Attorney General. And he went into the Justice Building, and there's a statue of Lady Justice holding up the scales. And of course, her breasts are exposed. You know what happened when he was Attorney General? He had it covered. He dressed her. He didn't want people coming in and seeing breasts. I mean, you know, this is, but it was at another place in another time in another era, in the Victorian era. You say, what's going on here? All this sexy, you've seen all of this stuff. And they would go into art museums and you see paintings on the wall, all these nudity, right? And you say, what's going on with these people? Art always captures the future before anybody else understands it. And they saw that what was coming was a sexually wild society. Now, let me tell you this. What we now have in architecture, and you can see this in Philadelphia, are walls of glass. It's almost Puritan, isn't it? Walls of glass, almost no decorations, no gargoyles, no fancy stuff, no gingerbread on buildings. Remember in the Victorian age, you look at the old Victorian houses, appeal to the senses. All this gingerbread stuff, now houses are what? Very straight, here's the word, functional. You say, what's going on? Sociologists say, within the next 25 to 30 years, expect there to be a conservative reaction against sexual behavior in this society, and that we will move more and more into a restrictive era. We've been in a very permissive era. The art foresaw that. Now the architecture reflects what? What is coming? And get this, artists always capture the future before the philosophers, before the social scientists can even comprehend it. And so it was Sorokin's concept. If you really, as a sociologist, want to understand the future, you've got to study the art of the era. The art of the era will capture the future before anybody else does. Fascinating stuff. And so you can get his book, Social and Cultural Dynamics, in which he deals with the sociology of art and shows how you can use art to analyze social systems. And when I was teaching in a regular course in sociology, one of the experiments that the students would have to do is go down to the Philadelphia Art Museum, go into the art museum, pick out five paintings, find out when the painting was painted, go back and research what the society was like that created the art. What was Florence like? What was London like? What was Paris like when that piece of art was produced? Number one, what was it like? What does the art tell you about what the society was and what it was becoming? Write up a paper using art as a means of doing social analysis. This is much more interesting than statistical studies. There's a whole area called the sociology of art. You can study society using art as a means of analysis. And certainly that was the case. The architecture of the Columbia World Exposition was Louis Sullivan, very important architect. Louis Sullivan. Another man was Daniel Barnum. He was in charge of the whole project. And after he was finished designing the great city, the city beautiful that was the exposition, the city fathers of Chicago hired him to redesign Chicago itself, which was just coming out of the Great Fire. And the city of Chicago was designed beautifully. The great boulevard up and down. It's one of the most beautifully designed cities anywhere. Incidentally, there are people like Lewis Wirth would say, the boys and the older kids play on the streets. Where do the children play? Where do children play? They can't go out in the streets. It's obvious. They play on the sidewalk. His answer was, instead of building parks, make the sidewalks wider, which is what they did in Chicago. Make the sidewalks wider. Give the children more room to play. The kids are going to play in the street. The children are going to play on the sidewalks. There was an architect that ruined this country. He was a French architect. His name was Corbière. I don't have the spelling down, but you can get that out of your textbook. And his vision of the future, he was really an artist. He should have never been an architect. He designed these cities of the future, and all of them had one thing in common, soaring skyscrapers. And so when they were developing government housing at the end of World War II, Corriere's model of the future became the hallmark. So government housing was built in these high-rise apartments. In Philadelphia, there's the last remnant of it at 56 and Market Street. It's called West Park. And these are skyscrapers. But once again, there was no imagination here along the lines of Lewis Wirth. What does Lewis Wirth do? He studies how people function in a city. Whereas Corbière was interested in how can we create an interesting piece of architecture? And so you have these soaring skyscrapers. There's a problem. The people that are going to move into these places, government housing projects, generally have lots of children. So the kids lives on the 20th floor. He's playing out front. What do kids have to do after about 3 hours? Go to the bathroom. Have you ever seen kids who up until the last minute? You see them, they're holding themselves. Do you ever see kids holding themselves going like this? Because they hate to leave the game? And so the kid runs to the elevator, but guess what? He doesn't make it to the top floor. So where does he pee? In the elevator or in the hallway. And so it's not long before the whole stinking building is a stinking building. And you can't go into these places without smelling urine all over. Once again, with no forethought, who's going to live here? How are they going to function? Sociologists should have been called in instead of just an architect who says, here's some space. How can I make this space attractive? If you go to West Park and you can see there is enough space around the buildings, they could have built single unit housing all over that place and created enough units to house everybody that's in the high rises. But after all, we had an architect who was interested in what? The beauty of the thing. Well, it doesn't look very beautiful now. And what has been happening, of course, over the last 10 years, starting under the Clinton administration, is tearing down these things and building low-level government housing, very attractive, very, very, very lovely units. And it is changing the way of life. Planned cities is the last thing I want to talk about at this juncture. I want to talk about Columbia, Maryland. In the downtown Philadelphia, there are two skyscrapers that were built by the Rausch brothers. And it was the Rausch brothers that built Columbia, Maryland. This was a planned city. Now, I talked about natural areas, did I not? And I talked about how natural areas break down. And so you got an area over here, especially with Burgess' vision of concentric circles. Here's where the rich houses are. Here where the working class houses are. Do you got this pattern? And here's the black community. Suppose we buy into Stephanie's belief to mix up all of these communities. Will it work? In answer to the question, Stephanie, it did. It worked very well in Columbia. What they did was they built a city from scratch. But instead of having government housing for the poor in one place and rich people living in the main line, they integrated all the housing. So a rich family might be living next door to a welfare family. Have you got the picture? Exactly what your question was suggesting, which is why I came back to it time and time again. I just didn't want to deal with it when you were talking about it. A breaking down of natural areas, blending people together, a planned city in which people of different ethnic groups, of different economic groups, of different cultural backgrounds were brought together. And then in addition to that, each area was carefully planned to have a recreational center with stores around them and places where concerts could be performed. And what happened was that Columbia became a very wonderful place to live, in which people who were upper class learn to appreciate the music of this ethnic group. And people who were black were not only understood but appreciated. Welfare people were recognized as not people who were inferior and stupid. They're their next-door neighbors. And in fact, when you're living next door to a well-kept house, there's a strong likelihood that even if you're a welfare family, you're going to do what? Keep your place well. We run this program, as I said, under Urban Promise. Remember, I talked about our inner city program in Camden. And what happens is you move a bunch of kids from upper middle class communities all of a sudden into the city, and they move into this area where everybody's throwing trash out in the front of the house, and the place looks like a mess. You know what? After about 2 weeks, the house that these middle-class kids are living in is a mess. You walk in the place, nobody's straightened up anything. It takes them about 2 weeks to become slum dwellers. To, in fact, say that people are not affected by their surroundings is a very serious mistake. And when we're dealing with welfare people, we need to go one step further. You say, but these are people, they are shiftless, they are lazy, they screw around, they have children out of wedlock, they're delinquent, they're shiftless, on and on and on. In the book that I wrote, I give reference to a study that was done in Switzerland. This is very important. Is there any question that the Swiss people are known for what? Efficiency? Cleanliness? I mean, if you go to Zurich, the whole city, you get the feeling the whole city needs an enema. Everybody's uptight. The trains run on time. Everything operates with optimum efficiency. It is clean. It is efficient. You're saying, whoa, how do the Swiss do it? They had a drug problem. They knew how to handle it efficiently. I told Joshua how they handled it. There's a park in Zurich for the drugs. And you don't have to worry about drug pushers in Zurich. They give them to you for free. So why would anybody buy them? You got to go to this park. And you use them and you stay in the park. It's the most depressing place you've ever seen in your life. But what it has done is it's disengaged the druggies from the rest of the city, number one. And number two, when you realize, as your book will indicate, that at least 60% of all the crime in a city like Philadelphia is drug-related. I mean, when people get addicted, they become desperate. They become prostitutes. They become thieves. They become robbers. I mean, it's awful. They mug people just to nurse a drug habit. All of a sudden, you say the drugs are for free, Zurich. You want drugs? You're not going to buy them on the street corner. You're going to go to the park and get them for free. You say, you ask the question, and do they come and pick up the dead bodies? The answer is yes. But you have to understand the German Swiss. Maybe it's a good idea that these people do die. I mean, that's their attitude. That's their attitude. I mean, you say, that sounds almost Nazi. A little bit of lingers in Switzerland, if you know anything about Switzerland. It's not a very nice place, ethnically. They don't like African-American people there. I just thought you ought to know that. It's not a good place to go if you're African-American. Okay. Unless you're dressed in African garb. That's another story.
Unless I'm from Africa.
Okay, yeah. That's very easy then. Dress African.
Okay.
Don't dress like an American. Understand that? Right. And they will treat you with great respect. But if you're an American black, that's another story. Be this as it may, it's not, I find it an uptight place, but everything is efficient. Everybody works hard. I mean, you see people walking to work, and nobody walks. They almost run to work. Everything is run, work, work. The Protestant work ethic is here at par excellence. These people are working, intense. Everything works with efficiency. I mean, these cities are wonderful, if you like efficiency. If you've traveled around Switzerland, you know that in the hills, there are villages that have no roads going to them. The only way you can get there is by train. They have these little one-car trains that go up in the hills. So a study was done on this one community of about 10,000 people that was far removed up in the mountains, accessible by train. And guess what they did for a living? They produced something that became world famous. What were the Swiss known for?
Chocolate.
What?
Chocolates.
Chocolates, that's what they're known for now. Yeah. What were they known for 50 years ago?
Clocks.
Clocks, very good, clocks. And even more specifically, a Swiss
watch.
They made these precision watches, famous all over the world. When I was a kid, if you had a Swiss watch, you had the best. There was a problem that they didn't face up to. The Japanese, in the meantime, had developed watches like the one I'm wearing that work off of a little battery that, in fact, are brilliantly accurate. More accurate than even the most efficiently engineered mechanical watch. And they never understood what was happening. They knew that the Japanese were producing these new watches, but after all, it was so prestigious to have a watch with Swiss mechanisms that you wouldn't want one of those. Little did they know that very, very expensive watches would end up being produced with little batteries in them. And this whole city that was built on one industry alone, making Swiss watches, went out of existence. The business closed down. Note, total unemployment. And when people aren't making money off of the watches, they can't spend it at the stores, you can imagine the economic catastrophe that befell. And it wasn't as though they could go to the next town. There was no next town. You got the economic tragedy of all of this. The study covers what happened to the people in this village over a 10-year period. Every problem that you can find in the worst ghetto in America existed there. Premarital pregnancies soared. Divorce down the wild. As a matter of fact, people started living together out of wedlock. Gangs began to emerge. Every single problem that you will find in North Philadelphia, the streets were dirty. The houses were falling apart. This community disintegrated. The name of the book in which this was first brought into American sociology was a book by an African-American sociologist, perhaps the foremost African-American sociologist of our time, William Julius Wilson. You should know that name. William Julius Wilson. And the name of the book is entitled When Work Disappears. Very important book, especially, Iola, you should read this book, because what it does is it compares what is going on in this dilapidated African-American neighborhood in Chicago with what was happening to these people in the Swiss village when work disappears. And what you see is the sociological similarities are so great you cannot ignore them. Single-parent homes all over the place. The thing that happened, of course, was that Switzerland is an almost socialist state. And so when work disappeared, the welfare system came in. The Republicans will love this. Republicans will love this. And all the people in this village didn't have to leave because the government gave them checks, even though they were unemployed. But the question is, what happens when people get checks from the government and they're unemployed? What happens to them psychologically? What happens to them socially? What happens to them sexually? How does their behavior life change under the impact of being unemployed? And this is very important, because what it does is it destroys racist concepts very quickly. Because if you're talking about race, you can't say the German Swiss, clean, efficient, behaving themselves according to the rules and regulations of society, Gestapo-like. Not when the work disappears. And the point is, if that happens in a village in the hills of Switzerland, why are you surprised when it happens in North Philadelphia? Thus, you cannot solve the problem of North Philadelphia with social workers. You can only solve the problem in North Philadelphia by doing what? Creating jobs. Do you understand why this fledgling program that we're just getting underway here at Eastern in urban microeconomic development is so important? Not because it's a nice idea to help some unfortunate people. It's the only way to keep total social disintegration from happening. It's not going to work if you get some preachers up there to say, you must be sexually pure. We must establish biblical values. You know, it won't work. The socioeconomic conditions are going to, in fact, determine the behavior of people, except in unusual cases, because of unemployment. Any questions on this point before I move on?
You know, there was a marketing study about that, the Swiss watch thing.
Yeah.
And one of the ad campaigns they came out with was these two men fighting with samurai swords. And one had a Japanese watch that was digital, but battery operated. The other one had a Swiss watch.
Yeah.
And so the one guy is not the guy with the Swiss watch isn't winning. So he says, "What time is it?" And the other man had to stop and push a button to tell the time. And the guy cuts his head.
There you go.
Just to show the because they were desperate for they were losing. I mean, I thought it was a funny marketing study.
That's a good ad. I love that. That sounds funny. I want to now move into other aspects of urban life. Yes, Chris.
Can you kind of talk about what levels of altruism is involved in urban microeconomic development? Because you're going to have to pay more when people are coming up with their own enterprises versus, say, Walmart. And can you talk about how you formed that collective consciousness?
Yes. Two things. Here the church has got to step up and do something. I did tell you about South Amboy, did I not? And the graduate of Eastern that went up there and took over this church, and it grew and grew and grew, and the way he took over the whole town of South Amboy. Did I tell you about that? Let me tell you about this particular student of mine who was in a senior seminar, and in his senior paper, he wrote a paper analyzing the Black Muslim movement in Chicago. He was intrigued with Muhammad Elijah. And he was intrigued. This was before Malcolm X was shot and killed. The role of Malcolm X in Chicago and the whole way in which these African-American people in this new religion that calls itself Islam but is not Islam by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the Muslims, true Muslims, in fact, deplore the Black Muslim movement. And are insulted that it even goes by the name Islam. As you may know, they shot Malcolm X because he dared to do something. He went to Mecca, you know, for the Hajj. Every Muslim in his lifetime is expected to make a trip to Mecca and march around the Kaaba, this great stone, black stone. Nobody knows where it came from. Gigantic. Did you ever see pictures of the Kaaba? This gigantic cubic stone that's black that somehow is supposed to, as you walk around and pray, your sins are absorbed by this rock. You're expected to go to do the Hajj once, and he does the Hajj. Up to that point, he believes black Muslim ideology, which is that the white man is the devil. And they have this whole history of how there was a mad scientist in Africa who, out of the black race, bred this race of evil people deliberately so he could use them to take over the world. They accuse this man of being the founder of the Masonic movement and how he led them out of Africa into Europe. And as they were led out, they all wore these little aprons. And of course, the black Muslims say, and even till this day, do you know when the Muslims are in their temples, they wear the little aprons from when they were led out of Africa. It was through genetic engineering that this evil race was created. White people are the creation of an evil scientist to do evil and raise havoc in the world. If you begin to see the white race as basically evil, it doesn't create good race relations from their side. And every once in a while, Farrakhan, who is now the head of the Black Muslim movement, will make statements and you will realize how hate-filled it is. He'll call Jews worms and call them fungus. And the Jews are the worst element of this genetic breeding, breeding these evil races. But all white people are evil. Malcolm X describes the journey. You really must read somewhere along the line. The autobiography of Malcolm X is when he goes to prison. And that's where they recruit him. And the guy that recruits him, the fellow inmate, says to him, life has been hard for you. Yeah. What was difficult in your life that wasn't created by white people? And then they just say, as he says, he didn't give me any answer. He just says, think about it. Next week, we'll talk about it. But in the next week, think of all the evils, all the problems that you have, and ask which of them were not created by white people. And then the simple line, the white people is the devil. The devil is not one person. The devil is a race of people. That's an interesting attitude, isn't it? Therefore, and this was the genius of the success of the Black Muslim movement, therefore, don't look to the devil to help you out of the mess you're in. Which is what Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King and all these people were trying to do. They were trying to get the white people out of guilt to respond to their needs. Give us reparations for what you did to us because of slavery. And make more welfare benefits available. Create affirmative action. They were expecting the white establishment to do all of these wonderful things for the black community. Forget it. It's about time you face up to who these people are, said Elijah Muhammad and Farrakhan. These people are the devil. It's not that they're influenced by the devil. They are the devil. Do you expect the devil to do any good for you? No. Therefore, all the good that happens in our community is good that we must do for ourselves. You can understand why Republican politicians would love the black Muslims. They want nothing from the government. Why? Because what the government giveth, the government taketh away. You know what the government is doing with welfare? The right-wing religious right would love the black Muslims. They're using welfare to destroy your families. You see, when they give you welfare, then the wife is no longer dependent on the husband. And he loses his position of power and authority. Welfare destroys the family. Therefore, if you're going to join this new religion, the black Muslims, you do not take welfare. You say, how will I live? We will take care of you when you have needs. But in the meantime, we're going to find you a job. A job? What job? Microeconomic development was initiated by the black Muslims before guys like Camp Polo ever thought of instituting it in Philadelphia under the name of Jesus Christ. And they set up their own stores. If you know anything about the black Muslim movement in Philadelphia, they have their own stores, their own cleaners, their own butchers, their own bakers, their own candlestick makers. They have their whole infrastructure. Namely, you don't shop anyplace else but where? In a black Muslim store. You establish all of these stores. And my goodness, yeah, all the people in our religion will shop in your stores. Don't worry about marketing. We'll market for you. They will go and shop in your butcher shop. They will, in fact, get their clothes cleaned in your clean. They will buy their clothing in your stores. They will buy their groceries in your places. And if you go through Philadelphia, as the black Muslim community emerges in Philadelphia, you will see these stores all over the place with Islamic writing on the front of it. You don't even know what they're selling. You got to know the Muslim language. You got to know Arabic to be able to read the signs. You say, well, these people don't know how to speak Arabic. They didn't. You set up your own schools. And you teach them Arabic. boys and girls all over Chicago are, who are African American, who are in this religion, are bilingual. They know how to speak and write Arabic, which incidentally, as the Jewish community is in conflict with the Arab world, guess how the black Muslims react? Who do they identify with? Do you begin to see how these tensions begin to work themselves out? And here in the United States, the tension is great. As a matter of fact, if you go to certain black Muslims and they're on the street giving out their newspapers, and you go up and talk to them, in most instances, they will act like you're not there. They will walk. You'll say, "Excuse me, sir, can you tell me how to get to Market Street?" They will act as though that you never even spoke to them. And they dress well. Little bow ties. And they have their own stores. And the whole infrastructure is they get people to buy at their own stores. So here,
has that been successful, though?
What's that?
Has that been successful?
Very successful.
In Chicago?
Very successful in Chicago and in Philadelphia and in Harlem. It's worked very, very well. Very, very well.
Because that was one of the knocks against the black community, is that they didn't buy from each other. Yeah. Whereas the Spanish and the
this is
the
exactly
Korean.
This is exactly they're saying go into North Philadelphia. Here's the solidly black community. Guess who owns the grocery store? Some Korean. You got these Asian people who come in and take over the infrastructure, and there's tremendous hostility between African Americans and Asians in the inner city. Primarily because they see and they have this idea that somehow the U.S. government gave the Asians money to start these stores. And why should the government finance these Asians when they're not doing anything for us? Of course, it's a myth. But if things are real in the imagination, they are real in their consequences over and over again. Very frightening thing to see in the city, is it not? But this student from Eastern, while he was still here at Eastern, needed some money to stay in school. So we worked to get him this little church just outside of South Amboy, New Jersey, which is across the river from Manhattan in North Jersey. A dilapidated city, if ever there was one. I mean, the worst kind of place you can imagine. And it was one of the first really dilapidated micro-cities in America. It's bad. It's Camden, only worse at that time. So he moves into this little church that's on the outskirts of the town, Second Baptist Church, little stone building. And he starts being the pastor. But this guy, Donald Hilliard, get that name. As a matter of fact, in my book, I make reference to Donald Hilliard. I talk about what he's been able to pull off in South Amboy. Donald Hilliard, who is now not only the pastor of the church, but he is a part-time faculty at Princeton Seminary, because he's figured out how a church can be the lead institution to reclaim a city. This guy is a genius. This African-American guy, student here, goes up to do the student pastoring thing, but he can preach up a storm. I mean, this guy can preach. And the church begins to grow and grow and grow. He's on the edge of the city, and he makes his decision. He gets enough money not to expand the church, but to do something else. Here it is. He's going to buy the porno movie in the center of South Amboy because it was once a gigantic theater that would hold 3,000 people. And his congregation is growing. He buys this porn theater, closes down the porn theater, which is a good step in the right direction. You know what happens in inner city slums, don't you? You have a movie theater, and the movie theater can't make money, so eventually it resorts to what? Showing double X, triple X rated movies, and that keeps the movie theater alive. He buys it out. Makes it into a church. It's called the Purple Cathedral. Sits there, because of course the front of it is painted purple. He raises enough money, I think it was $6 million, which back when he was doing this was a huge amount of money, and remodels the building. Very important process. He remodels the building, and after remodeling the building, the church continues to grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And then but when he was here at Eastern, he was doing his senior seminar paper. And the senior seminar paper was built around one thing. I'm going to study the Black Muslim movement in Chicago and ask whether the same thing can be done with Christianity. Whether we can, it's a great model. Why do the Muslims have to have it? We're going to have it. And so he establishes a system in South Amboy that follows the Black Muslim movement. But unlike Chicago, South Amboy is a small city, which means over a period of time, he can take over the whole town. Got it? He starts buying up all the closed stores on Main Street. You've been to these old cities where they have all, you've seen these old cities. The stores are all boarded up, closed up. Nobody wants to rent them. The businesses have all closed down. He opens them all up, establishes an array of stores, and he puts his own people to work there. Nobody in the church is allowed to be on welfare. We'll give you a job. I mean, it's the same model. We're going to give you a job. And so he creates all of these jobs, restaurants, great restaurants there, all kinds of restaurants there, Chinese restaurants run by African Americans. I mean, you name it. They got it. He redevelops the whole city under the auspices of the church. The church buys up these buildings, refurbishes them, starts stores in them. Now, the congregation is still growing to thousands and thousands of members. You say, I've never heard of this church. Of course you haven't. He doesn't care about publicity. This is a real man of God. He's not out to make the front page of the New York Times. He's out to rescue a city. He's out to transform South Amboy into the kingdom of God, where God's will be done in South Amboy as it is done in heaven, where everybody will have a job, where everybody will have a decent house to live in, where there will not be children dying in infancy, where old people will live out their lives in perfect health and well-being. You got the image? We taught him well. Your job is not to get people into heaven. Your job is to get people converted and filled with the Holy Spirit so that they can transform their community into the kind of community that God wants them to be. All of a sudden, we see the working out of this whole system. Stores are built, etc. When I went to preach there last time, he invited me to preach, his old professor. When I went there to preach, he said, when you arrive in town, this is where you're to park. You will be met there by the fruit of Jesus. Do you know where that term comes from? If you know anything about the Black Muslim movement, there are these bouncers who dress up with little bow ties. Big, husky guys. If you've ever seen Farrakhan speak, the fruit of Islam, as they call him, is standing behind him, big and strong. They never crack a smile. They just stand there. The whole time he's speaking, scare the daylights out of you. The fruit of Islam will meet you. And they will walk with you to church. You get to church, you get up to speak, guess what? The fruit of Islam stands behind you. You pay attention. You look like you're drowsy. You might be in real trouble. They are there. The choir comes out. They don't wear regular robes. They're all in most beautiful African garb you've ever seen. It's third generation nativism. We're going to revitalize African values, African way of life, African dress, African music. The whole community has come alive. I met the chairman of the deacons, who happened to be the mayor of the city. And I said, this is convenient. That you got the mayor of the city and you elected the mayor of the city, the chairman of the deacons. He said, no, you've got it wrong, doctor. He is the mayor of the city because he is chairman of the deacons. The police are basically run as a police department should be run. Inner city police departments get horrible reputations except in South Amboy. These are brothers and sisters in the faith. The whole city is being taken over. And he's Baptist, but he doesn't go by the name Baptist. Remember, this is African. If you're a great Christian leader in Africa, what are you? You're not a reverend. You're a what?
Bishop.
You're a bishop. And so here's this guy. He's the only Baptist bishop I know. Bishop Hilliard, if you go to the church. And really, it would be worthwhile for you to go to the church sometime and drive up to South Amboy. And this is why I love sociology. It suddenly makes, you drive through a place and you think you're seeing it, and you're not seeing it all. There's stuff going on here that you didn't even pay any attention to that has emerged. An answer to your question, Chris, and that's a long answer. It is up to the church to nurture people who recognize that they have an obligation not to shop at Walmart. That to shop at Walmart is immoral. And it is immoral because the stuff that's produced and is sold in Walmart is made in the People's Republic of China. I think it's over 80% of everything that's sold in Walmart is made in the People's Republic of China at slave labor wages. They're destroying. There's a study done by the Harvard Business School which points out that certain industries control the wages of people in America, that certain industries set the wages and all the other companies end up conforming to it. It's a classical study at Harvard. And they go through American history over the last 100 years. They point out that at one time, the major industry was the railroad industry. Therefore, whatever salaries people on the railroad were making, and they were the first to unionize, as you know, whatever the railroad workers were making, there was a tendency for all other companies to kind of conform to this dominant industry. After World War II, railroads went into decline and the automobile industry came into play. As you know, the automobile workers were paid very, very high salaries. Good unions, they got good salaries. They were making like $15 an hour back when $15 was a fortune. And there was a tendency for the automobile industry to what? To draw all other wages up to its level. And so everybody else ended up being paid more and more and more and more. It affected all the other industries. Do you got what we're dealing with here? Now, the Harvard study goes on to say that the automobile industry is no longer the dominant industry in America. The dominant industry in America is Walmart. Please note, Walmart's gross profits in any given year far exceeds General Motors. Well, General Motors doesn't make profits anymore. But the sheer sales level, the amount of goods that are sold, I'm not talking about the net, I'm talking about the gross, is way beyond General Motors. All the jobs that were so much a part of the automobile industry are disappearing. And people are going to work at Walmart. But Walmart, in most instances, pays minimum wage. And what's happening to the pay scale in America because of Walmart, asked Harvard Business Review. Wages are coming down all over this country, from one end of the country to the other. Do you want to support an industry that's destroying the income of the American people, Chris? Is that what you want to do? I want to ask you as a Christian, do you want to participate in destroying the American working man, the American working woman like that?
I mean, this is a very one-sided question. I'm talking about low-income neighborhoods, and is it really our place? And it's so tainted with privilege to tell people with low incomes not to shop at Walmart. And in a value-free system of sociology, where Walmart is 1% of the gross domestic product of this country, we're not tackling it correctly.
The point of these people would be quite simple. We're going to make sure that you don't live on minimum salary. We're going to make sure that we'll start our own businesses, our own stores, where you will be able to earn enough money to live with dignity. We're going to deliver you from poverty through microeconomic development. We're going to give you jobs, and we're not going to pay you minimum wage. And because you're getting paid so much more, you shouldn't work at Walmart. After all, we've made sure that you've gotten a job that enables you to live with dignity. Don't you owe it to the brothers and sisters who helped put up the money for your business and your job? Don't you owe something back to them? You say, where did they get the money for these businesses? They would take up offerings at church. Our brother here wants to start a new business. He wants to start a cleaner's down the street. We're going to pass the plates around, and we're going to take up a collection. They will differentiate between a collection and an offering. We're going to take a collection to help Brother Chris start this new cleaning store that he wants to establish. Now, we've gotten you this store. You're making some money. Don't you owe it to the brothers and sisters that put up the money for you to get started to go back and shop in their stores and work in their places and to buy from them? Do you see? You're creating a micro system here. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the fact that when you do urban renewal, you don't try to renew a city. This is what's wrong with governments. They try to renew cities. You only renew a natural area, a natural zone, and you work in that area, and we're going to transform this natural area. That's what the Muslims do in Chicago, and that's what's replicated here. You're raising a good moral question. Is it right to tell people where to shop?
Well, that, and also, is it practical? Is it replicable? I mean, in Chicago, you've been there. You see the fragmentation of the church. The congregations are not...
The fragmentation of the church, not the fragmentation of the Muslim community. Exactly. And the reason is that the Muslim community is built around an economic system, and the churches are not. And so, in fact, the churches are disintegrating, and the Muslims are growing stronger every day because, I hate to say it, even religion ends up being impacted by economic factors. That's what I'm saying. You are analyzed right. The fragmentation, the falling apart of churches, the decline of religion in the city is in Christianity. And we all sit back and tremble and we know what's going on. Even as Christianity is in decline, the Muslim community is on the rise. And we're asking, why is it? Is it because Islam is so true? Or is it because they have created a socioeconomic system that offers hope to people who hitherto had no hope at all? It's a very serious question. Is the church, when I said, is the church able to do what I think the church ought to do? Should the church be the lead community? In this case, was the Muslim religion the lead community, the lead institution of the neighborhood, leading the rest of the institution to complete renewal and revitalization? Not the city government, but the religious institution did it. And what they've done is showed that it can happen that way. And what Don Hilliard has done is said, we can do it too. Now, you have to dig through this stuff. But the question is, can you develop religiosity without an economic base? There's a good question for you. There's a word for a PhD dissertation. Can you develop religiosity without an economic base? You say, my gosh, you've made everything determined by economics. Even religion. Except for one thing. What I am proposing is not that religion be influenced by economic factors, but that the religious community initiate the economic development. Then it's not so much that the church is being controlled by the economic system, but the economic system is being controlled by the church. That's what's going on in South Amboy. Yeah.
But, you know, Chris brings up a very hard point to argue because I can get a better product. It may look better. It may feel better. I don't know, long-lasting, but it's less expensive. And the world market, I mean, how can the local guy really tap into the world market to compete at that level with
you're
Walmart?
You're absolutely right.
I mean, that's a hard...
Every time you buy a bargain, and the bargains are incredible... People in many instances don't even send their clothes to the cleaners because they can buy new ones cheaper than it takes to get the old ones clean. You know that, don't you? Whenever you have a bargain, remember, there's somebody who's suffering because of your bargain. I told a student earlier that one of my friends was in Africa. I can't remember the country right now, where 80% of the coffee beans that are used by Hershey Candy is produced. It's in East Africa. But at any rate, the reason it came up is because we were making a tape on trafficking and slavery. And over half of those beans are picked. Hershey doesn't do it. They simply buy the beans. They simply buy the beans. Got it? They don't do it.
Nike doesn't make their own shoes either.
Yeah, they don't do it. It's another group over in Africa that does it, you see. Incidentally, during the days of slavery, we weren't the ones. The white people in America, white people in England, weren't the ones who went and conquered blacks and put them in chains. It was what? It was other black tribes raiding putting black brothers and sisters in chains and selling them to the white slavers. Right? We didn't dirty our hands and go in and create the slaves. We simply bought them from African tribes. This is the reality. But what are you going to say? Well, after all, and people did say that, we're not the ones who created the slavery. Can't you just hear them in the antebellum South? We were simply buying these people. And given what was happening to them in Africa, we probably gave them a better life over here. They began to rationalize these things this way. Hey, you can get labor very cheap. Point. Yeah. And the slavery was causing somebody else to suffer. Point. The point is this, that this situation was such that Steve Chalk, who is very big, I talked about him earlier, this British evangelist who is a great organizer of people in the United Kingdom. Steve Chalk was in one of these villages where these kids who picked the coffee beans, over half of all the coffee beans that are picked in this country, and I can't remember the name of it right now. Even if you gave me the name, I wouldn't be sure it was the country, because you asked the question out of nowhere. Over half of the children, over half of the pickers of the beans are slave children. They are slaves. And so Steve, who is going to be leading a charge in the United Kingdom, along with Rob White, who is putting together this great movement to stamp out trafficking, he goes and tries to study the thing firsthand, and he goes to this village, and he's talking to one of these boys who wakes up every morning, and he's a slave. I mean, there's no way out for him. He'll be a slave till the day he dies, unless there's a revolution. And says, I'm going to go back to the United Kingdom. He could have well said, I can go back to the United States. When people buy candy bars, chocolate bars, and eat them, what shall I say to them? This is a 12-year-old kid, said to Steve Chalk. The next time one of your people eats one of those chocolate bars, remind him, he's eating my flesh. Whoa! That's powerful, isn't it? We're so blasé. You say, wait a minute, Campolo. Are you suggesting that our buying habits should reflect Christian values? Or are we going to be totally immune to religious values in our buying habits? And there are many young people that are emerging in today's society that says, if you're going to be Christian, what you buy has to be conditioned by Christian values. Very important question. It's an ethical question that you're going to have to deal with. It's a question you're going to have to answer. Low-income people love Walmart. You're saying, don't go there when it costs much more to buy your products elsewhere. And the answer is, in the name of Jesus, yes. Do not patronize what is in fact encouraging the exploitation of children in the third world. Do not patronize what is hurting people in the third world. That's the way many people think. Now, you can argue both ways, Chris. I mean, you can be a pure economist. Incidentally, there's a name for economics in academia. Do you know what we call it? That dreary discipline. That dreary discipline. I mentioned to you, if I didn't, I should have, a book that really conditioned me and got me thinking in a whole new way. And you can buy it in secondhand bookstores. It's a book by E.F. Schumacher entitled Small is Beautiful. And the subtitle of the book is Economics as Though People Really Mattered. What an interesting statement. I mean, the idea that we should do economics as though people really mattered, that our buying and selling and production should be considering people. Let me tell you the best way for poor people to get money. Steal it. And don't you think a lot of poor people do that? Steal it. You say, but that's immoral. Is it any more immoral to steal than to buy products that were produced, which necessitate the exploitation of 7-year-old and 8-year-old kids in third world countries? Is it any less immoral? See, our whole moral value system has to be rethought in terms of these things. You say, my goodness, you're going to turn the whole economic system upside down. And the early Christians were criticized wherever they went because lo and behold, the minute that they hit town, it was said of them, lo, The men who have turned the world upside down have come here too. If you read the book of Acts, religion controls economics. They go to the city of Ephesus. The major business in Ephesus is making little silver statuettes of Diana of Ephesus, who is the goddess of the city, so that people can establish little worship centers in their homes. It was the major business. All of a sudden, these Christians hit town and they start converting people left and right. And guess what? They don't want to buy these silver statues anymore. And the silver merchants go ballistic. Read this in the book of Acts. The Bible is incredible in understanding the social economics. So what should we do? Should we stop preaching the gospel? Because after all, when people get saved, they're going to stop buying these silver statuettes. Now, we can, in fact, say, is there something that's more functional that can be built? That's the good Christian answer. Could we do something else with the silver? But it happened so fast. The winning of people to Christ was so enormous that they had to say, what? What are we going to do? And they riot. If you read the book of Acts, they riot against the Christians. Why? Because becoming Christian has changed the buying habits of the people of Ephesus. Now, how can you read that in the book of Acts and say, but it doesn't pertain to us? Does becoming a Christian change your buying habits? I think you have to answer that question. It's a good question, isn't it?